which I do with the greatest of pleasure. First, I'd like to mention Dr. Hospers, whom I have known for almost a quarter of a century. I met him in Denver, Colorado in 1972, at which time he drew up the Statement of Principles for the Libertarian Party, and of course subsequently ran, as you know, on the Libertarian ticket for presidency. I've come to know John through the years, through correspondence and meeting him here and there at gatherings such as this, where he has been a speaker, and we have become quite good friends over the years. I am, without abashment, a fan of his. I greatly admire the gentleman. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I'll let them speak for themselves. I now come to Barbara Brendan. I knew of Barbara because I was the Nathaniel Brendan Institute rep in Toronto for 1 year, at which time I met her, but very briefly. And last year in Athens, we became reacquainted, and I think we have now become very good friends. Again, I'm a fan and an ardent admirer. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I introduce these two wonderful people to you. I'm sure they have a message that you will carry with you for some time to come. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. John Hospers and Barbara Brendan.
Thank you very much. I thought I would sort of skirt around the edges of the topic first, since I didn't know I'm as well as Barbara does, and then she will occupy the center of the subject after me. I came to know Ayn Rand in the early 1960s when she gave a lecture, Faith and Force, at Brooklyn College where I was teaching. And after that, I invited her to lunch and she said, okay, I've got 1 hour. That was at noon and we were still sitting there discussing philosophical subjects at 6 o'clock. I didn't know that that was the beginning of a comparatively long relation. I knew her saw her regularly for about 3 years before coming to California in the later 60s. She went to an NBI lecture, and then I was invited to her apartment. I came with a very much marked copy of Atlas Shrugged, and she said, I'll trade you. So she gave me an autographed copy of hers. I said, well, these comments in the margin are really, they're just my own reactions. They're not necessarily the most important things. She said, that's all right. That's why I want them. I want to see what your spontaneous reactions are. And she said, at first, if we want to discuss Atlas Shrugged, we'll discuss the aesthetic aspects. I want to know what you think of it as a work of art. Well, that helped to get our friendship off on a very pleasant footing, because, of course, I had nothing but admiration for Atlas Shrugged. So I discussed with her the structure of it and the intricate way it was put together. Even at her request, she wanted to hear favorite passages, what passages I liked the best. And so I seized upon several of them. First of all, the one of the opening of the railroad in Colorado, and that turned out was one of her favorite passages. I said, "Well, but you know all this. I mean, I want to hear from you. What you think of these various points?" And so, for several evenings, we usually met every 2 weeks. So, for several evenings, we discussed various aspects of it. She said, well, we'll leave the philosophy alone for the moment. I just want your aesthetic reactions. Well, from that, we went to other things. We discussed various works of literature. I had memorized considerable parts of Shakespeare, and I would quote some of those to her. She wasn't too impressed by Shakespeare. And I never did get an agreement with her on that. Too much of a tragic sense of life and so on. But there were other things on which our reactions corresponded precisely. She indicated, she showed me a few things that she enjoyed in literature, and sort of to my surprise, she turned to some poems by Swinburne. She said, "No, this is not philosophy. I don't necessarily agree with his views, but just as pure poetry, this is near perfection." And I agreed, but I also thought that Shakespeare's sonnets probably merited that same praise. Anyway, we went through that a number of times, and we got onto music. It was about at that time that she was starting to have a weekly broadcast on the Columbia University radio station. I think it lasted for about a year, and we wanted some opening music. So I brought along a whole bunch of records. I thought good introductory music. So I had some of Handel, Handel overtures, bits of Bach, Purcell's Trumpet Voluntary, things that I thought would just be ideal to introduce a program. She didn't want any of those. What she wanted, she said, all these, this is the 17th and 18th century, that's a static universe. I said, well, if you want a dynamic universe, how about Beethoven? How about Wagner? Well, she didn't want those either. We ended up with what was her favorite, Rachmaninoff. Her two favorite composers were Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky. I didn't consider it accidental that they were both Russian. She thought that all aesthetic judgments were objective. She said, I can't prove it in the case of music. She said, I don't know what to say about those, but she said, all these are objective qualities that I discern. And then I said, look, I think that a lot of the terms that we use to praise or dispraise works of art, terms like beautiful, terms like appealing, terms like expressive, they have more to do with our reactions to the work than they do with the nature of the work itself. I said, now granted, many of them may be a mix, but I said, we have to disentangle these because we want to keep apart the terms that describe something and terms that describe the qualities of something and those that describe our reactions to it. And there was some degree of disagreement there. It's very difficult to encapsulate in just a few minutes what took place over a long time and then was forgotten again and then resumed at a later time. We did a great deal of this. It is through this, through aesthetic concepts, that I got an idea of what objectivism means. All aesthetic qualities are objective. They're out there. They're really in the object, you see. And I expressed some doubts about that. Not that I was a subjectivist. I wasn't. But I said that many qualities, many so-called qualities, including the secondary qualities, as they're called, like color, shape, smell, objects, those also may be relative to the state of the observer and dependent on the observer's organism and so on. I always try to think of exceptions to whatever general principle is enunciated. That sometimes irritated her, but sometimes she enjoyed it as well. And so we had spent some time on secondary qualities and then the so-called tertiary qualities like beauty and goodness and so on. But in general, her position is they're all really out there. Could we but know it? The difficulty is in our appreciation. And I didn't necessarily agree with that, but we would go from one subject to another in a friendly way. She think her ideal art was always heroic. And like Atlas. And I think I was much more tolerant of a lot of things in art that she was intolerant of. I liked Picasso, she didn't. I liked James Joyce. She had no patience with James Joyce at all. And there were occasional arguments about this, friendly arguments. I would sometimes take her to concerts and ballet, modern dance. She didn't always like it, but we had a great time there. And there just isn't time to discuss everything that I could say about those wonderful evenings that we spent in restaurants, concert halls, and so on. Then we'd go to her place and talk until 4 o'clock in the morning, and very often we're still talking at 8 in the morning, and she'd make me breakfast and I'd go off to class. And that happened many times over a period of several years. It's difficult to give a brief impression of this. I think I was somewhat more pessimistic in my view of the universe than she was. I've mentioned once, for instance, the status of animals. I said, which animal would want to come into this world knowing that they'd only be prey for other animals, none of them living to old age, all of them, say, dying from hunger, disease, and so on and so on. She didn't exactly deny that, but she thought I was emphasizing the wrong thing. In fact, although I was pessimistic about that, I told her, look, I'm just trying to take a realistic view of things. I'm not personally depressed. I feel life is wonderful, but I'm just trying to see the universe as it is. And curiously, when I expressed some reservations about the profession I was in, teaching, that I would have a class and I'd try to clarify their concepts and I'd work hard on the students, and then the term or the year would be over, and just as they were starting to get somewhere, then you'd have a whole bunch of new ones the next term, and then full of the same mistakes as the previous ones, and then it would all start over again. And I said, this is becoming monotonously repetitive. She said, no. She said, you are in the most influential profession in the world. You may not know it, but you are. It's ideas. It's ideas, not physical things, that mold the world. And she said, it's when bad ideas replace good ones, that's when we have the kind of world that we have now. I never forgot that. It sort of gave me renewed inspiration to go ahead with my profession. And I never, since then, reached the doldrums in my feeling about the profession that I did at the time, that I was in at the time that I met her. Well, all right. We disagreed a lot about contemporary philosophy. She hadn't read a lot in contemporary philosophy, especially Anglo-American. And it was difficult to convey a brief impression of that because so much of this involves multiple meanings of words and things that she didn't really have much patience with. And I thought that this was the important and essential avenue for getting to that. She thought, apparently, that most modern philosophers, by modern, she meant 20th century, that most modern philosophers were skeptics about the existence of a physical world. And I said, well, they take the physical world to be a hypothesis which is highly confirmed, if not totally validated. I said, but none of them deny it. Well, she thought that it would be unusual to find a philosopher who took the existence of the physical world as axiomatic and did not require any argumentation. And I showed her a long article of one of my favorite contemporary philosophers, Norman Malcolm of Cornell. I still remember the article, and I typed up the argument of the article for her called Knowledge and Verification. And the conclusion was that knowledge of certain things about the physical world around us is not just probable but active but certain. And she said, let's get him over here and talk with him, because this would be the exception in contemporary philosophy. I said, no, that's not the exception. The modern philosophers are not what you apparently think they are. They may put on a skeptical guise, and they may say a lot of things that are skeptical, skeptical about perception, skeptical about science, skeptical about religion. You can be skeptical about all sorts of things. But she was always suspicious of that, thought that I was presenting contemporary philosophy in all too rosy hue in order to promote it to her. And to the end, she had very little patience with it. I might have come through to her on a few things, but our backgrounds were dissimilar. I didn't really fully understand what hers was until I read Chris Yabara's book on Ayn Rand, which came out last year, about her education in Petersburg and so on. That's a long, long story, which I can't go into here. But we had lots of friendly disagreements, some of them not so friendly. I always tried to be easygoing, friendly, but I could see the signs of impatience and sometimes anger rising. There was always a reason for the anger. She was, for instance, I remember that one night I quoted her quite casually, Anatole France's statement, the rich have the same right as the poor to sleep under bridges. And that really set her off. It just, she was apoplectic with anger. And I didn't understand that at the time. I subsequently saw, you know, she saw so much in that, but to refute it, to talk about property rights, and how if there were sufficient attention to property rights, the things that were described in this about the poor sleeping under bridges would not occur. I mean, that was a long, long story, and I wasn't yet all that into free enterprise economics and so on, but we went into that quite a bit later. When she had these bouts of anger, I could always detect that there was something very profound behind it, and I didn't always realize what that was. So I tried to keep an even keel and just tried to learn from her, and I did learn a great deal from her, even as I tried to teach her some things about contemporary philosophy that she really didn't know, or some things I thought it was misrepresented to her, and I tried to give it a fair appraisal. There are lots of, and I don't have time to go into those, I'll go into one or two very briefly. We discussed, for example, causality, and I casually threw out the suggestion to her once upon a time, if A occurs and then B occurs and then that happens again, A, B, A, B, A, B, then we have some title to say that A caused B. And she immediately recognized this as Hume's constant conjunction theory of causality, and she didn't like that at all. Of course, I was about to augment this theory. I wasn't satisfied with Hume just as it was stated, but I said, if you're in a theater and you're hearing the clattering of horses' hooves on the film, and just at that moment an earthquake shakes the theater, you get the impression that the earthquake is what caused the clattering of horses' hooves. I said, but if it turned out at every time you saw that film there was an earthquake in the theater, then you would suspect that there was some causal relation between the two. That was an example of what was ordinarily called the regularity view of causation. But I said, of course, be careful. A person can say, I get up an hour before sunrise every morning and bow to the east, and lo and behold, every morning the sun rises. But lest I think that my action caused the sun to rise, one morning I won't get up, and then I'll see what happens. And then you'll know what does and does not help cause the sunrise. So I went into this in quite a good deal of detail, and she said, yes, but that's not enough. In causation, the cause acts upon the effect. And I said, okay. But now let's see what this phrase, act on, means. What about situations like, traditional situation, this domino is near that domino, and the first hits the second hits the third, and so on, until the tenth one comes down. This is causation by contact. This is the most familiar one, the familiar to us in everyday life. That the one acts upon the other, in a clear sense. Now, what about this situation? The sun is over here, another star is many light years away, but there's a considerable gravitational attraction from the one to the other. What acts on what? Well, the sun acts on the other star. Yes, but there's it certainly is not in the traditional way, because there's nothing between them. I said, well, in the 19th century ether hypothesis, there is something permeating all space that is between them. But I said, that theory went out at the end of the 19th century and has never been revived. But I said, Would you say nevertheless that that's acting on? Huh? Seems to say yes, that was acting on, even though it action at a distance. Yeah, that seems to be okay so far. Then we got into discussion of ESP. I didn't know that was such an explosive issue with her. I just wandered into it, unknowing, and I was presenting some data that I had read about the so-called Shackleton experiment in Great Britain about. A person in one room guessing what cards were being pulled simultaneously when a bell rang in another room, soundproof, three rooms away, and so on. A bunch of scientists there to make sure there was no dirty work going on, no cheating of any kind. And here's one person who almost always gets it right. I mean, here's a bunch of cards, spades, clubs, and so on. And suppose that when clubs is being drawn over here, the guy over three rooms away always guesses correctly what it is. I said, no, that's if you define ESP as one mind having access to another mind without the intermediary of the sense organs in between, this seems to be a pretty good case of ESP. And no. She thought it was shameful that I even read that stuff. That's not the way nature works. You're misconceiving the nature of the world. I said, well, but you can't just say a priori what nature is like. You can't just figure it out as you do in mathematics. Sometimes you have to look and see. And if the evidence favors ESP, and I don't care whether it does or not, but if it does, well, then we have to accept it, even though we can't explain it. This seemed to me just eminently commonsensical. She never got over this. She thought this was not the way nature works, and I should have known better to begin with, and any attempt to show that ESP might actually exist is fraudulent. I mean, I should be onto the fraud before I even started with the business. I said, well, you can't really know these things a priori. Some things we have to look and observe. And see, and that was a regular. Things like this became a regular bill of fare between us. When we talked about the causal principle that everything that happens has some cause or other, and I. She thought that it was true. Yeah, and in general, I did too. But I said, what is the status of this statement? Is it a statement at all? Since, I said, it's epistemologically very suspect, don't you think, Ayn? Because every time we find a cause for something, we say, yeah, the causal principle's been further confirmed. But when we don't find it, we don't say it was disconfirmed, we say, we haven't found it yet. And when I see those one-sided businesses, I get suspicious. So that is what led some people to say the causal principle is not a statement about the world at all. It is a kind of rule of the game, the rule of the scientific game. We adopt it as a rule. It helps us to find more causes and encourages us and so on, has certain pragmatic effects, but maybe it's neither true nor false. Well, and I've mentioned a lot of things that look as if they're statements, factual reports about the universe, and maybe, I said, maybe, just maybe, they're not reports of the universe, what the universe gives us, it's what we import and bring to the universe. And we see it through some of our own expectations and desires. Well, that smacked a little bit of Kant, although I didn't put it in those terms. And again, that was totally rejected. There was a whole bunch of issues like that. I mean, we discussed definitions. We discussed a great many, just hosts of philosophical issues, and just some scientific ones too. In general, she didn't have a lot of sympathies with certain developments in contemporary science. She totally rejected, say, the Heisenberg principle of indeterminacy and so on. And again, Einstein's statement, God did not play dice with the universe. But when I suggested, well, you know, maybe the indeterminacy is right out there in nature. It's not just that there is a definite situation and we don't know what it is, but it's that indeterminacy is really out there. She was sort of ashamed of me that I should think such a thing. My head wasn't really on quite straight, that I that I would say things like that. And so it continued. I'm only giving a very, very brief impression, and I'm almost through. We discussed theory of definition many, many times. I don't have a chance to do all that right now. Anybody that wants to ask about it will amplify on just about anything that you care to discuss. But I just wanted to give a brief hint of the sort of thing that we sometimes talked about. Sometimes she'd get very angry at something that she thought I was confused about, or something that I had said, and then she'd go into the kitchen and prepare tea, and I'd hear the clattering of cups, and she'd come back and say, this was a philosophical anger. It's not a personal anger. It's not directed against you. And so sometimes when I said something that she very much approved of or liked, she'd say, I love you in the true philosophical sense of that term. Oh, I didn't know exactly what that was, but I wasn't going to ask any. And so I'd say, well, that's true of me in spades, Hein. Well, 30 years have elapsed, and I still miss her tremendously. I think of her on all kinds of occasions. Barbara and I were discussing this the other day. She was saying that when the Berlin Wall came down, she was thinking of Ayn, and I was too. And the same now today, that her books are available in Russian in her own native Leningrad. It's unfair that she didn't live to see that. That would have been tremendous. When the Ayn Rand letters appeared, it was an experience of vividly re-experiencing things of many years ago that I thought had faded from memory somewhat, and they hadn't. When I wrote my book on ethics a year and a half or so ago, and I was writing at it, it's the book I have before me here, Human Conduct, just came out earlier in 1996. I thought of her a great deal. It wasn't primarily about her. She does figure prominently in it. And I discuss her a bit, and especially issues like the refutation of socialism. I thought she would like that. She would appreciate it. On the other hand, I could also hear her saying, John, I told you so. This isn't right. You shouldn't say that. But I also might think, I'd say, yes, you were right about that. You still have the 19th century mind that I like. Forget about the 20th century. Go back to the 19th century and you'll be okay. How many times she had said to me variations of things like that. Maybe she would even have said, maybe. I'm sorry I got angry with you about this, because now I see where you are coming from. Anyway, it's many years ago, but it was a great experience, one that life would just not have been quite as wonderful if it hadn't happened. Okay, I guess I better stop there. But after Barbara's finished, any questions, we go ahead.
This is going to be an enormous change of subject. It will still be about Ayn Rand, however. Ayn Rand's life and work were a feminist manifesto. She wouldn't like me saying that, because she was, in the early days of feminism, very opposed to it, for reasons that we can go into later if you want. But nevertheless, I think that statement is correct, that her life and work could be taken as a feminist manifesto. Oh, dear. Excuse me, I'm getting over bronchitis, so if I cough at you, forgive me. I don't have to tell you, I don't believe, that her life was a manifestation of feminism at its most exalted. This was a woman, whatever her faults, who never lost for a split second her independence of mind. When she didn't like the philosophical system she found, she created her own because there was no one else to do it. You know that she fought against enormous odds all her life. She was hated by most of her culture, but she went on and she fought and she fought. And even at the end of her life, when she was ill and sad and weary and disappointed, she decided she would write, and she began writing a television script of Atlas Shrugged because she had become convinced that nobody else could do it. Whatever are the most admirable qualities of feminism, and there are many, Ayn Rand exemplified them. Feminists, of course, don't like her, but the feminazis don't like her, if I may use that expression. The ones who see the state as the solution to all human ills. They would do well to study her. They would find in We the Living, Kira, a young girl who fought alone against the brutal weight of communism, who dreamed of building glass skyscrapers and aluminum bridges, and who all her life, her short life, held on to the independence of her mind despite living in a world that was nothing but the reverse propaganda. She used her mind, she went her way, she made her own decisions, and she loved as passionately as she fought. In Atlas Shrugged, they would see Dagny, a woman of giant intellect who ran a railroad, who also loved deeply and passionately, who made her own life by the decisions of her own mind. I believe very strongly, and there was never any question of this, never any contradiction to this, that women properly were purposeful, independent, active, productive, that they were the intellectual and moral equal to man. But what I want to discuss tonight is an issue that has sometimes been seen as a contradiction to this kind of feminism. It has been troubling to many of her readers, and it puzzled me for a long time. And I'm referring to the sex scenes in her books. May I add that though I suspect some of her readers are troubled philosophically, I don't think I've met many who are troubled emotionally. All of the sex scenes, and before I came here, I went through her books and checked just to be sure. All of them, it's not only in the famous rape scene in the Fountainhead, have what is often seen as a disturbing amount of violence in them. All of them, whether it's Kira with Leo, whether it's Dominique and Rourke, Dagny with Francisco or Galt, they could equally be called rape scenes, equally with Dominique and Rourke in the Fountainhead. That is, the woman is taken violently by the man, often seemingly against her will. She's helpless against the power of his sexuality. That's the common theme that runs through all of these scenes. With one proviso, and again, I checked every single sex scene to make sure this was so, and it is. Ian once was asked about the rape scene in the Fountainhead, and her answer was wonderful. She said, if it was rape, it was rape by engraved invitation. And that's true of all her scenes. The woman has given permission, not necessarily in words, but at least tacitly. The man knows that he's passionately desired. And let me just read you a short passage that occurs between Dagny and Galt. Quote, he held her with a tense, purposeful insistence, his hand moving over her breasts, as if he were learning a proprietor's intimacy with her body, a shocking intimacy that needed no consent from her, no permission. She saw his smile, the smile that told her she had given him permission long ago. That's the typical theme of all the scenes. In attempting to explain this, I may very well be accused of psychologizing, but I don't think that's what I'm doing. I did know her for almost 20 years. I was her closest female friend. She talked to me alone about very personal issues. And I spent 4.5 years working on her biography. That's a way of coming to know someone that is very difficult to communicate. Imagine how well you know whatever person is closest to you. And you probably know that person extremely well. But imagine taking 4.5 years out of your life to do nothing but understand that person fully. That's a kind of knowing that, let me give an example of the kind of knowing it is. Occasionally, I'm quite unlike Ian, occasionally I would be trying to figure out what she would do or say in a certain situation, and I would begin introspecting to find the answer. One literally has the feeling, writing a biography, that you carry that person around inside you for that period of time and can learn certain things, not by looking outside at her, but inside at yourself. And that's often where I found answers that didn't pertain to me, they pertain to her. So I hope what I'll be offering you is informed opinion, not psychologizing. I've been convinced for many years that any writer's sex scenes represent their own personal sexual fantasies, that they're not simply invented out of whole cloth for the purposes of a novel. They come from very deep within the writer's own psychology and from the writer's fantasies of the nature of transcendent sex. You have nowhere to go but inside yourself to find, to explain through somebody else what sex is all about. Okay, how do we account for Ian's view of sex, for what is demonstrated in her books? The first issue that I will just mention, because I don't think it was of great significance, of some. You know, I think one of the definitions, though I wouldn't dare try to define genius, but one sort of approximate, almost definition, is that a genius is the person who will question as much as is humanly possible about the things other people don't think to question. That is, we're all brought up in worlds, small worlds, large worlds, in which we hear certain things said or implied every single day of our lives. We don't make a judgment about them. They're sort of in the air we breathe, and so we go along without doubting them or thinking about them. They seem self-evident. The genius is the person who questions the self-evident, which Ayn Rand certainly did. However, no one in the world can question everything. Everyone carries some emotional baggage from their past, some issues that they think are true simply because they've never thought about them. What I'm talking about specifically in this sense is guilt, which in many ways was very alien to Ion psychology. But I suspect, I do not know, that there was some... Ayn Rand was born in Russia and brought up in Russia. There would be no way for that I can think of for a young girl in that very sexually repressive atmosphere, especially a young girl who would have become aware of her own intense sexuality very early, not to carry some touch of guilt with her. And the reason I suspect this is that in her sex scenes, since the woman is taken violently, she bears no guilt. She hasn't initiated it. It's not her sexuality that causes the sex act, it's the man's. Now, as I say, I think this is a small element. The next one is more important. Ayn was, in one sense, rejected by men all her life. It began with Leo, the man she loved in Russia. She once told me that if Leo had asked her to marry him, she would never have left Russia, and she probably would have been killed there. But she would have stayed. She loved him that much. He rejected her. I saw the reason. The rejections throughout her life were not in the obvious form in which Leo rejected her. But I saw, even when she was in middle age, if we were at a party, I would see men and women throng around her to listen to her. But even among her contemporaries, there was nothing personal, and I saw the men around her scared to death of her. She's just too smart, too impressive, too aggressive intellectually. They back up. They're drawn to her, but as men, they back up. I don't know that she was ever consciously aware of it, but she had to have felt it. And I think what that did was make her very, not afraid, but uneasy about initiating with a man. And again, in her sex scenes, she doesn't have to initiate. The man initiates. Another reason that I think they are as they are. In such a sexual encounter where the man is the very active one and the woman submits, the woman can drop her controls. With Ayn, it was an issue of dropping iron controls that ruled her life. She could drop the struggle, drop the battles, drop the aloneness, and surrender herself to a force that was stronger than she was. I think this was very important psychologically. She felt so much alone in the world, so much that whatever was going to happen in her life, she had to make happen. Nothing was coming from the outside. In this sexual context, a great deal was coming from the outside, from the man. He was entering her world, and she didn't have to initiate. The most important thing that I think accounts for these scenes, for the quality of them, is that in childhood and all through her life, she was stronger and wiser and more courageous and braver and smarter than anybody else she met. If she met her equal, I never heard about it. It was hard. It was very lonely for her. She suffered a great deal for it. She wanted desperately to find at least an equal. What she wanted even more than that was to find someone wiser than she, braver than she, more courageous than she. There was a desperate longing to find that, and she never did. throughout her life, she never did.